The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekend radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. Great to be with you. This week, after weeks of speculation, the president uses his emergency declaration powers to deal with the crisis at the nation's southern border.
I think there are some people that are very concerned about what sort of precedent this sets.
And almost immediately, and like clockwork, 16 stations challenge the president's move in court. How will that fare?
It's not like what many people say, akin to, well, what if Kamala Harris said, I declare a gun emergency and I'm banning all the guns.
Also, National Review's Rich Lowry joins Eric Metaxas in studio. We'll look at the media response still unfolding to the unexpected presidency of Donald Trump.
If you just looked at New York Times front pages, you never would have thought he had done anything right or had any chance to win.
All this and more. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Hear my program live each weekday afternoon and learn more at WAVA.com. We'll begin with the national emergency declared by President Trump as he seeks to deal with the crisis at the nation's southern border. There's no question that border security, generally, and the wall, more specifically, was the centerpiece in candidate Trump's campaign and then as Republican nominee, an oft-repeated promise that helped propel him to victory over Hillary Clinton in 2016. And 2 years into his first term as president, Donald Trump has surprised friends and foes alike. He's trying to do what he said he'd do. Perhaps we shouldn't be so surprised that he's turning over every leaf in an effort to get funding for a wall. And in declaring a national emergency, the president received a host of criticism from the right as well as the left. For a closer look, we'll turn to Andrew Malcolm of the Heritage Foundation. He was a guest on my program. Are you surprised, first of all, by the president's decision, and is he, at least first glance, on solid grounds, legally?
No, I'm not surprised, because he's been talking about doing it for a while, and, you know, I think it's a shame that it's come to this. I wish that Congress had negotiated in better faith with the president in order to secure our southern border. But I do believe that he is, in fact, on very solid ground in doing this. I think there are some people that are very concerned about what sort of a precedent this sets, and there is no question that the National Emergencies Act gives the president fairly broad authority. But there are other statutes out there that constrain what a president can do. And in this case, you know, the president has talked about the other funds that he's going to tap in order to get this wall built, and he cited the statutory authority that he's relying upon, and I think those statutes give him the authority to do this.
Well, there's an article you've written. Trump has a strong legal argument. He can declare national emergency at border, and it's found at dailysignal.com, for example. And early on, you say that he really, even in the State of the Union address, was laying the groundwork for this possible decision, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he's talked about this problem from a number of different perspectives. During his press conference, he really referred to this as a sort of invasion. He's talked about the increase in drugs coming across the southern border, a 73% increase in fentanyl, 38% increase in heroin and methamphetamine. He's talked about our overwhelmed immigration courts, a backlog of 800,000 cases. He's talked about gang members and cartel members being stopped by ICE agents and Border Patrol agents. He's talked about the criminal organizations that make about $2.5 billion in human smuggling and the plight of those migrants who are smuggled across the border with, you know, a third of the women claiming that they've been sexually assaulted, 70% of migrants claiming they've been assaulted in some form or fashion. And perhaps most distressingly, he's talked about the number of crimes that have been committed by people who were successful in illegally entering our borders over the last 2 years. I think there were 266,000 immigrants who were charged or convicted of committing committing 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crime, 4,000 murders. Those are rather large numbers.
Would you agree it's a fair question then to ask why such fierce resistance to anything this president has wanted to do in that regard by those on the left in particular, many of them claiming that he's exaggerating, that there is no major crisis that would require the declaration of a national emergency? How do you explain their position on this?
Well, I mean, a number of these Democrats voted in favor of the Safe Fence Act of 2006. It just didn't fund any money to build a barrier along the southern border. That includes, at the time, Barack Obama, Joe Biden, both of whom were in the Senate, Hillary Clinton, Chuck Schumer, Dianne Feinstein. The situation at the border has certainly not gotten any better since 2006. I mean, they're going to argue that, look, this is a real problem, but it is not dramatically worse than it has been before, that it's not a real national emergency. But I think the president has laid out a fairly compelling case. And as I say, there is statutory authority that says that when a national emergency is declared, that the president has the ability to appropriate, you know, take appropriated funds in order to build a barrier along the wall.
Is there not a great irony in what we've been through 8 years prior with President Obama doing so much, much of which highly questionable as to its legitimacy legally, and yet he did it with executive orders, and yet this man trying to simply stem the flow of illegal immigrants into the country is being excoriated by those on the left and fought on every front, including this is going to end up in the courts, is it not?
Well, it'll certainly end up in the courts. And there is, to my mind, a significant difference between what President Trump has done and what President Obama did. So President Obama had his Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, and then his DAPA program that he implemented using his phone and his pen, as he said. Those were programs that he put that flew in the face of federal immigration laws. He was allowing categories of people to come into the country and to stay here when federal immigration laws specifically excluded those people from the country and made them deportable. Here, the president is acting pursuant to a statute. He is invoking the National Emergencies Act, and he is citing authorities that Congress has given him to do exactly what it is that he wants to do. So President Obama was flying in the face of a statute. President Trump is acting in compliance with the statute. But you're right, there will be somebody now who will come along and file a lawsuit, no doubt in California, because California is in the Ninth Circuit, as opposed to Texas, which is in the more conservative Fifth Circuit, and we'll see what a judge does. If it happens like it did with the travel ban, you'll get some activist judge who will enter a nationwide injunction designed to prevent the president from doing this, and there will most likely be an expedited review that will probably end up in the belly of the Supreme Court.
If criticism of the president's decision was expected, so was the challenge in the courts. It seems like the press conference was barely over, and we received an announcement that 16 states had filed a lawsuit challenging the legality of the move. For a look at how this might play out in the judiciary, my colleague in New York, Kevin McCullough, turned to Sean Davis of The Federalist from AM 570, The Mission.
Where do you think this 16-state lawsuit goes?
So I come at this from the perspective of someone who worked on appropriations law in the Senate for several years. I was the main appropriations guy for Senator Tom Coburn, one of the few true fiscal hawks in Congress when he was there. And so I have a fair amount of familiarity with the process, and it comes down to two things. Number one, back in 2006, Congress, by pretty overwhelming vote margins, enacted the Secure Fence Act of 2006. And what that law did is it required the Secretary of Homeland Security to take all necessary action to secure the border up to and including building physical barriers, if necessary, from the Pacific to the Gulf. So basically from California to Mexico. And what that law defined as control or a secure border was that there were zero unlawful entries, whether that was goods or people or whatever you can imagine. That law requires zero unlawful entries across the border and requires DHS to build a wall to make that happen. So fast forward to Trump. He sees that situation. He sees that his Homeland Security Secretary has asked the military, please come help me. I'm having a very difficult time fulfilling the requirements of this 2006 law. I need military help. The Department of Defense responds. And when Congress refused to give regular appropriations towards the funding wall, Trump said, look, there's a bunch of these laws out there that allow me to declare an emergency, to use already appropriated military construction or Army Corps civil engineers money towards this requirement that a wall be built. And that's what he did. It's not like what many people say, akin to, well, what if Kamala Harris said, I declare a gun emergency and I'm banning all the guns. This is a very narrow area of federal appropriations law that will be narrowly decided, and I don't think it's a particularly close call.
Well, and that's interesting, given the fact that the public speak about this has been so broadly misrepresentative of the actual legal questions in play. I mean, you really narrowed it down in your column to the 1976 issue of, does he have the authority to do that? That's without question. And then once he's declared it, can he then move within that space that is limited to do what is necessary? And it seems like there's a lot of support there.
There are. It goes back to this 1976 law, the National Emergencies Act, which at the time was trying to rein in presidential use of kind of extraordinary authority in the event of an emergency. And so what Congress said is, no, you can declare emergencies, but when you do so, we're going to only let you operate within this small box. And with regard to what Trump's doing now, what they said was, look, if you declare an emergency, which we authorize you to do, and you decide that the military is necessary to respond to this emergency, which you as commander-in-chief of the armed forces have sole authority to do, then we are going to allow you to use money we have already appropriated for military construction to go and respond to this emergency. And so that's what Trump did. He's not appropriating new money. He's not taking money out of some magical pot somewhere in contravention of Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. He is working within the confines of the appropriations regime, which Congress has created, that says you can declare an emergency. If you decide that the military is needed, you may use this amount of money from this particular pot to go do what you need to do. And as of last September, I think within that military construction account, there was about $13.3 billion that hadn't yet been obligated. So that would represent the ceiling of amount of money that Trump could go use to build a wall in this fiscal year.
Which is way more than he's asked for. And actually, Sean, maybe you can help break this down. I've heard that really the lawsuit only addresses about $3.6 billion of the $8 billion total, because nobody questions the discretion that he's using for the other five.
Right. And you know, I've read all the legal arguments on it. I think a lot of people are mistaking the question of should he do this with can he do this. And they've decided in their minds, no, he shouldn't do it. And therefore, we're going to make these tortured legal arguments as to why he can't do it. And on the right in particular, there's an a class of pundit who doesn't really care about the secure border, doesn't really want a fence, but they don't actually have the fortitude to come out and oppose the outcome. So instead, they build these arguments around the process. And they're all fairly, in many cases, they're disingenuous, they're made in bad faith. But most important, they're wrong. And so they wrap up their opposition to the outcome with language about their alleged opposition to the process. But as we've discussed, and as I analyzed by looking at all these laws based on my experience working on federal appropriations law, it's not a close case. For any other president, it's not a close case, which is why Obama and Bush between 2001 and 2014 used this exact same authority 18 different times.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership program offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
if you just looked at New York Times front pages, you never would have thought he had done anything right or had any chance to win.
National Review's Rich Lowry in the next segment of The Christian Outlook. Stay with us. Say what you need to say. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. Media bias. It's nothing new. It's nothing that we have not discussed on this program before. I know I've dealt with it on my program time and again over the years. But what we've seen in the age of Trump really needs a new label. Media bias is too soft and mild. We've witnessed something more like media meltdown in how they've handled the 45th president. Yes, Trump has poked and prodded and had some fun as he pointed out fake news time and again. My Salem colleague, Eric Metaxas, welcomed a veteran conservative voice into his New York studio, Rich Lowry, editor-in-chief of National Review.
We're talking about J. Edgar Hoover. Then you brought up Martin Luther King Jr. and his problem with committing adultery and philandering. Obviously, we know JFK brought prostitutes into the White House. LBJ was a swine. FDR had a mistress. On and on it goes. I believe that Bill Clinton even did stuff like in the Oval Office that he shouldn't have done. So when people today compare something that he said 12 years ago or something that he did 10 years ago to doing it while you're the president of the United States, like, well, how can we have not had a news media that has that historical perspective?
Well, I mean, they don't have any perspective whatsoever about Trump. I mean, they've been driven crazy by him. This is what I would say. You know, it's a difficult question, this intersection of character and political leadership.
Yeah, certainly.
But going back to Martin Luther King, who obviously, you know, carried on affairs, horrible. But one detail has always struck me, and I'm pretty sure I'm right about this. When he was assassinated on the balcony of the motel, they found him with his hand crumpled up on a cigarette because he didn't want anyone to see that he was smoking. So I think this is something we do want to ask from our public leaders. You have these terrible things. Please keep them private and in public, maintain a certain sense of decorum to try to elevate rather than tear down our public culture, our political culture. And this is just the thing that makes me most frustrated with Trump. I don't think he really tries. He airs out every single grievance.
Right.
You know, okay, he hates Mika. I get it. The show's really irritating. It's completely obsessed with Trump. There's no dissenting pro-Trump voice. Right. Fine. Tell Kellyanne how much you hate her. Don't, like, tweet it, you know? But he can't help himself.
Actually, that's very funny. I mean, look, we could talk for hours about what you just said because it's – to me, that is the issue of this presidency. It's like, where's that line? Where is it fun and healthy, mm-hmm.
right.
and where is it destructive?
Right. And that's the thing that the critics don't realize, never realize, is that word fun, right? He's hugely entertaining. He's just still like the biggest figure in American public life. And this came true in the primaries when he was leading in the polls. So he was in the middle position. He was taller. He was more voluble. You know, his hair looked better. He was oranger than everyone else. And that's all still true. He's just like the biggest figure. And despite the press constantly writing these stories and honestly sourced, you know, he's on the verge of a breakdown. He can barely get out of bed in the morning. He can't, you know, he's not going to be able to perform his duties anymore. He's never showed like the slightest weakness or crack in public at all. And so far, everyone he's confronted, he is diminished and destroyed. Elizabeth Warren's the greatest example. He probably destroyed Elizabeth Warren with one nickname and got her to do the DNA test that got her wrong side of the left-wing base, and she'll never be able to explain that
right.
away. So he got in her head, and that's why – that's the aspect of Trump I'd be most
he
worried about.
In her head. It's like funny. It's like trash-talking with – you know, it's like –
yeah.
I guess it's kind of like when you think of, let's say, Reagan – and Gorbachev and what personality means. In other words, we have policy and then we have personality.
Right.
I mean, look, Elizabeth Warren, I actually find the whole concept of her even thinking she could be president funny.
Right.
Because, you know, you realize that we all think we could be president. She thinks she could be president. It's just funny to me that when you think of the field out there, half of them I find funny. That why do they think that they're going to be president or they just have a chance? But it seems to me that what the Trump-hating press has done is they take anything negative or possibly negative and twist it and amplify it. And so in a way we confuse, like we say, well, that's Trump. Well, it's not really. In other words, if it were up to him, what he said on this hot mic or that mic would never have seen the light of day. But
right.
people have seized on even just slight nuances that are confusing, and then they pump it up.
Yeah, like one of my favorite examples of this going back to Russia is the Lester Holt interview. So you listen to the average cable show, you'll believe that he told Lester Holt, I fired James Comey to shut down the Russia investigation. He didn't say that. What he said is I fired him because I think there's nothing to Russia and Trump, and I know this act is probably going to extend the investigation. So how's that obstruction when you actually said, oh, I did this and I know the investigation is going to go longer and I'm not shutting it down? But they get that so wrong. But just imagine if that interview had been conducted in private and we didn't see it with our own eyes or hear it, we would hear the worst version of it getting exaggerated and the crudest version of it. And that's what basically happens with all these leaks and inside stories.
Well, look, let me ask you, for example, about CNN. I mean, there was a time some years ago that I would watch CNN now and again trying to get a slightly different take. And it sometimes was a centrist take. It was news. I never dreamt that I would see what I have seen. And it's not just a CNN issue. It's an American issue that it's as if we genuinely no longer have journalism in America. Pretty big to say that. I mean, we have friends, many, on CNN. What do you make of the phenomenon? I mean, did they make a decision to do this?
I'm one of them. I'm a CNN contributor, so I shouldn't discuss CNN. I'll talk about the press more broadly. And I think a key inflection point was in August 2016, after he won the nomination, and the New York Times used lie in a headline about him and then congratulated itself about using the word lie. And the rest of the press thought it was wonderful they used the word lie. And for me, that was where the brakes really were just lifted. And they went into outright opposition. And it's true of every story. You know, we say it about like Jesse Smollett stuff. We say it about social media mobs. Wait 48 hours. It's true of everything. I pay really close attention to immigration policy. And any immigration story, horror story that comes out, I wait. I talk to people in the administration. I try to find out because it's always almost invariably so tendentious when it's not actually factually wrong.
Well, the New York Times can stand in for CNN since you're not a New York Times contributor. I look at the Times every day, and I cannot believe what has happened to that paper. They manage to spin every front page story as anti-Trump. Now, that's not easy to do. They do every single one. They spin it against Trump.
Yeah, there was I said this in 2016 after the election. If you just looked at New York Times front pages, you never would have thought he had done anything right or had any chance to win. And that's why briefly there was about a 48-hour period of reflection. Like, we got this wrong. We got to examine about how we go about this. And then immediately snapped back. And obviously, this is it's really irritating to the president. He cares about it a lot. You know, we hear about it on Twitter. But it helps him. It helps him.
It helps him. Well, that's interesting you say that. I guess I'm just like you, worried about the ship of state, the idea that America ceases effectively to have anything like the journalism we once had, we all lose, basically.
Yeah. I think that it's kind of a golden age in journalism and the worst period in journalism ever. Because if you really want to find good stuff and you know where to look for it, there's a lot of it. It's instantly available in a way it never was before. But there's also a lot of schlock, and institutions like the New York Times that were supposed to kind of above it all, we used to kind of criticize them for being so Olympian, are now like in the game and playing to their crowd, like explicitly playing to their crowd.
To hear the complete conversation with Rich Lowry, go to ChristianOutlook.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up,
mainstream media making it a celebration of death. Well, we want to make this a celebration of life.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. We've talked about New York's abominable new abortion law here in recent weeks. Just briefly, in case you're unfamiliar with it, the law, passed in the state legislature and signed by Governor Cuomo, makes abortion legal right up to the point of birth. An abortion can be obtained for any reason or no reason at all. This came after Democrats secured control of the state Senate in November and thus eliminating political opposition. And the cheers from New York legislators were macabre.
The bill is passed.
In the wake of all of this, advocates for the cause of life have started pushing back. Our friends at Focus on the Family have been leading the way. Robin Chambers of Focus joined my friend Bob Burney from The Word in Columbus.
Focus on the Family is beginning a 12-week campaign dubbed See Life Clearly. Was the New York legislation that passed on January 22nd the catalyst for this campaign?
Absolutely. And knowing that, you know, there's several states that have similar types of legislation, you know, for years and years, obviously this, you know, on our radar. But when this became such mainstream, and I think when you see that video of men and women, you know, clapping, applauding,
I know,
you know, what's going on, that was when literally the team here just said, okay, stop. What can we do? How can we help? How do we really step into this in a bigger, broader way? And I don't know that you could get bigger or broader than a live ultrasound in Times Square. Mm-hmm. But this is a way for us to show the humanity and the dignity of that child. And but we know science is behind us, technology is behind us. You see a scan of that baby, even a really, you know, early term, it puts into perspective that it's not a clump of tissue anymore, that that is a child made in God's image, and it's time for us to step in and really call attention to that.
It's going to be a powerful event in New York City on May 4th. And why New York? I think it's very obvious, but I'd like to hear it from you. Why New York?
Well, you know, the kind of like you said, the catalyst for that was the legislation and just how that made, you know, front page news. But, you know, that is kind of the crossroads of the world. You know, there's so much that happens there, and it's such a busy, bustling place. But we want to show the New Yorkers that Focus on the Family is willing to step in and call attention to just the horror of abortion, and especially at that later term, and really want to show people that this is a life. This is this child and his or her mother is worth standing and fighting for. And what better way than to do it where this whole thing started with, like I said, just mainstream media making it a celebration of death. Well, we want to make this a celebration of life. We want to show life to those men and women in Times Square.
So how and when did you personally get involved in the pro-life movement? Why is this your personal passion?
I think you're going to make me cry, so I'll have to see if I can get through this without crying.
Oh, that's okay.
18 years ago, my son and his girlfriend had their first unplanned pregnancy, and it became very, very personal at that time. And then a year later, they had baby number two, and that little guy was scheduled for an abortion, and they waited too long to get a first trimester abortion, and called and asked to borrow $1,000 for a late term abortion, a second term abortion. And we knew then that our lives were going to change in a very significant way, and we stepped into that. And lots and lots of, you know, stuff has happened in between that, but those two children are alive and well today, and my husband and I actually raised those two, and they are the joy of our life. Taylor is 17, and she will graduate high school this year and go to college next year, and her brother Tristan is 16, and he is just a delight as well. And they were saved because I really knew I needed to get them to a pregnancy center, and those pregnancy centers that kind of spoke into both of those situations loved on my son and his girlfriend, now wife, and just really served them with compassion and grace and mercy. And I now have three grandchildren, but two that were unplanned and are alive today because of the work of pregnancy centers. And so it's a little personal to me.
Well, and that is often the case. It is often the case that those that are most involved in the pro-life movement are there because it is very, very personal to them. This is not some impersonal campaign. This is personal, and I'm delighted to hear that. I did not know that about you. So God bless you. That is wonderful, and you know, God gives us tears as well. So
yeah, thank you.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who impact public policy and serve in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up,
I can recall even in medical school, there was no option for me not to say I couldn't decline from observing abortions. I had to go into the clinic and watch them being performed.
More on our broken, our fallen healthcare industry when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Don Crow. The developments we talked about in that last segment, New York's macabre new abortion law, are really just a helpful window into the shifts we see in the medical care industry as a whole. Some of the other shifts are more subtle, but that does not make them any less dangerous. In the disciplined subtlety of a medical professional, we can miss the deadly realities of today's hospital room. Dr. Catherine Butler is doing some great work in this area. She was a guest of John Hall on Word 101.5 FM in Pittsburgh.
Katie, talk about, you know, because you start this article and you tell this heartbreaking story about a young woman who comes into the hospital. She's suffering an acute illness. She's also 23 weeks pregnant, and there her family's with her. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so, you know, medicine really is a gift from the Lord. It is. It has tremendous parallels in terms of our need to love one another as He loved us. But I think it's important to realize, and this is something that leaves people stranded when they're dealing with illness, that it's not a Christian institution. And it really came to light for me during one time in my practice when I was in the ICU. And there was, as you said, a young woman who came in, and she was dealing with an acute illness, but was also 23 weeks pregnant. And she expressed that she wanted an abortion. And her family filed in sobbing, pleading with her when they found out this is what she'd requested, saying, please, can we adopt the baby from you? We can figure out something. And it was just this outpouring of grief and love and tenderness. And it just was in very sharp contrast to the response of her care team. And they were all very competent physicians. They took good care of their patients. But the emphasis in the notes from her care team was on the fact that she'd requested an abortion. There was very little discussion with her about why and what she could be dealing with, where she would find that this is the only option. And the notes read like a sickly countdown, because in the state where I was practicing, abortions are legal up to 23 weeks and 6 days. And once the baby reached 24 weeks gestation, they wouldn't be able to perform an abortion. So there was this urgency in the notes for her to recover from her illness so that they could perform the abortion.
Right. So as you say, there's this magic time frame, right? There's not personhood, and then at this self-appointed time frame, which was, I don't know where that comes from, I'm sure you could speak to that, that baby automatically becomes a viable person.
Right. Arbitrary between, you know, the only value before 24 weeks would be if the child is wanted, and that's what determines personhood. And then magically at 24 weeks, yes, this is actually a human being, and so we're not allowed to abort. You know, and it just brings into relief that even though my life and death and illness are so deeply spiritual, medicine itself is just not a Christian institution. And it can really leave people bereft when they're dealing with illness that there's no spiritual support.
That's interesting, because, you know, you would think when you look at, you know, even here in the city of Pittsburgh, there's many hospitals that essentially have Christian names, and they sort of have gone hand in hand in America for millennial.
Yeah. And there have been Christian organizations, because healing and medicine go hand in hand. But I think it's just important to remember that bioethics, so the principles that guide medicine that we all adhere to, they are an excellent way to protect people, and they're in sharp contrast to the situation that we had in the 1960s with the Tuskegee experiments that came to light. You know, the foundation of modern bioethical principles, it was in response to that travesty.
Right. So for our audience who is uninformed about that, talk about Tuskegee.
Yeah, so Tuskegee was a 40 years long horror where the U.S. Public Health Service funded syphilis research on poor African Americans without their consent. And
human guinea pigs.
Human guinea pigs who then were infected with syphilis. It was horrific. And so when this came to light, noting that it was public funding and then the whole travesty of it. It spurred a movement to define modern ethical medical practice, to really have guidelines.
So what happens then when there are people like you, and I'm sure that there are many wonderful mm-hmm. doctors, men and women who have given incredible expense and time and effort to be a healer, but then they're put into a position, whether it's they've got to perform an abortion on a viable, healthy baby, or someone wants to kill themselves, and there's a doctor on the front lines. I mean, there's an ethical dilemma there that you've got to face, I'm sure, often, if not on a regular basis.
Oftentimes, you can defer to and have them get another physician's opinion, say, I don't feel comfortable performing this. But I will say that the environment in terms of training is increasingly hostile to that approach. I can recall even in medical school, there was no option for me not to say I couldn't decline from observing abortions. I had to go into the clinic and watch them being performed. And this was before I really came to Christ. But I hear frequently from medical students who are in moral distress over that issue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no physician who has a moral objection to that would ever go into that field.
Right.
I think people are cognizant of this. You know, but it's a very, very good question, John, because I think that the training is becoming increasingly hostile to the idea that you can say, I'm not going to perform a given service or participate in this kind of training about these practices. That's becoming increasingly frowned upon.
I see. Dr. Butler, you talk in your piece, The Hospital is Not Heaven, about Michael and Tracy Belboni and their book, Hostility mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. Hospitality. Tell us about that, please.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent book that I would highly recommend. It's very academic. It's not a light read. the two are a husband and wife team. He is a theologian. She is a radiation oncologist. And they've actually performed outcomes research looking at the importance of spirituality in recovery or dealing with terminal illness, and also looked at the responses of physicians and the degree of support. And there are huge discrepancies between how frequently patients, even those who were not didn't declare themselves as religious before illness, how frequently patients will seek out a spiritual understanding and spiritual support in the setting of a terminal illness, and how infrequently physicians and other providers respond to that. There is a real divide between spirituality and medicine that leaves people adrift. It's an excellent book. It's called Hostility to Hospitality, and I highly recommend it. But the one phrase that really sticks with me, it's on the very first page of the book, they make the declaration, American medicine is spiritually sick.
To hear the complete conversation with Catherine Butler, go to ChristianOutlook.com. I want to talk to you for a moment about ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Now, you've seen how your freedom's under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and for generations to come. Go to ChristianOutlook.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure that the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Coming up...
Even faith-based movies are like, oh, you know, if everything's going to be happily ever after. It's just not true.
Yeah.
It's not real life.
Tim Tebow and his Run the Race film in theaters this weekend. When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Tim Tebow is a familiar name to many of you. College quarterback with some great moments in the NFL, aspiring Major League Baseball player, a strong believer, and now the producer of a film out this weekend. He joined Kevin McCullough to talk about Run the Race.
Why a football story about two brothers your first film?
It really impacted me. And it wasn't necessarily to do with the football. I think that was just to happen to be a piece of it. When we read it, it was the relationship. It was the struggle. It was the real life about this. And so many movies that we saw growing up and that still come out today, and even faith-based movies are like, oh, you know, if everything's going to be happily ever after. It's just not true.
Yeah.
It's not real life. And I'm sorry to break it to you. You're not always going to win. You're not always going to come in first place. But how even in the midst of it, we can have faith, hope, and love. We can walk away encouraged. We can walk away inspired. We can walk away ready to take on real life, and how there's ups and downs in real life, just like in this movie, but how you can see God work throughout it, the highs and the lows, not just in us, but through us.
After throwing for 300 yards against the Steelers on a year where you were told that you didn't have the right kind of throwing mechanism, and then bouncing around another couple of years, I was one of those dads that really wanted to see you back in the NFL and my boys so that they could have a chance to kind of know the Tim Tebow story. Where are you at sports-wise? I know the Mets organization is still in play. What are your goals? What are your hopes?
Well, from what they said, I'll be starting in AAA, but the goal is to get to the bigs. But that's not just a win if I get there. It's a win that I get to live out my dream and be able to pursue something that's on my heart, even in the midst of a lot of criticism for it. And I get to, to do something that I love. And I'm passionate about that.
You've taken every opportunity when something looks like a door has closed or what have you, and you've always been able to use the platform that God has given you to turn light and illustrate something else. When you were playing at Florida, did you ever think that your life would be ending up where it is and kind of just a very non-conventional path?
I didn't know. I mean, there's probably a part of me that thought, hey, God, this is awesome. We just won two championships. I'm going to go win a few Super Bowls and it'll be great.
And then I'll get to work on the other stuff.
Yeah, I'll honor you the whole time. But, it doesn't work out like that. But also, not everybody can relate to the highs, but most people can relate to the lows. Mm-hmm. And so...
Has that given you greater impact with your...
Totally. I think so, in my opinion. It gives you... more relatability to be able to share that. Most people have been told their life, you're not good enough, you can't, you shouldn't, you won't. And I've been told that a lot, and so I can encourage them in the midst of that, and I do want to encourage that, as I feel like I'm here to encourage people going through lows, not the people that think they're on the top of the world. I want to encourage, my goal, our foundation's mission statement is to bring faith over love to those needing a brighter day in their darkest hour of need. That's where I have the biggest heart for.
To hear the complete conversation with Tim Tebow, go to ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, remember to subscribe to our podcast and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Let me again say thanks to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For executive producer Russell Schubman and producers Charlie Richards, David Fosian, and Mike Cook, I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.